This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, January 28th, 2013. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. KUAF is supported by the Center for Arkansas and Regional Studies at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville, dedicated to the celebration and documentation of this region's history and culture. Support for KUAF also comes from Eureka Springs, celebrating fun in February with Mardi Gras parades, jazz events, costume balls, and a special art exhibit. More information, including a vacation planner and newsletter registration, available on the web at eurekasprings.org. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, we look at the entrepreneurial spirit in our area. Last week, some heavyweight business mentors were in Northwest Arkansas as guests of the University of Arkansas Office of Entrepreneurship and the Northwest Arkansas Council. Also, a handful of schools have had to cancel classes this month due to illness. We investigate what factors go into the decision to close a school and what must happen prior to reopening. That and more. But first, former Florida Governor Jeb Bush, who was considered a possible candidate for president in 2016, will headline a school choice rally and summit at the state capitol tomorrow. In conjunction with National School Choice Week, activists are pushing for a policy reform on Arkansas's education system. Lori Lee is the executive director of the Arkansas Reform Alliance.
Former Florida governor has implemented sound policy in his state that has led Florida to make great strides in education. The best way to set policy in any state is to look what others have done, good and bad, and take the good and leave the bad and learn from other people's experience. So it's imperative that we, as Arkansans, are able to put our egos aside and look at other places and other states.
Jeb Bush was the 43rd governor of Florida, who served from 1999 to 2007. A caller to the Arkansans Ask program on AETN last night described himself as a conservative Republican who nevertheless voted for Democratic Governor Mike Beebe and asked why the partisan rancor is much worse in Washington. Beebe was ready with a theory, blaming it on gerrymandered congressional districts that force candidates away from the political center in fierce primary battles.
And so in the primaries, they're running to their extreme bases more. In other words, the Republican candidates run more to the right, and the Democratic candidates run more to the left. Is now stuck with all this stuff they've been talking about and all the promises they've been making and all the folks they've been trying to get, and usually end up getting elected more to the extreme on one side or the other. That means once they get there, there's not much left in the middle.
Governor Beebe defended the recent redistricting in Arkansas, saying the Board of Apportionment did a good job of giving weight to incumbency and community of interest, as court rulings have required. Late last week, Lifestyles Incorporated announced it has received accreditation from an international review body. CARF International conducted its survey of the nonprofit over a three-day period last month, and Lifestyles Executive Director Jennifer Maynard says the survey process takes a lot of preparation.
You have to look at all of your policies and procedures. The standards book is in several different sections, and it looks at everything from governance to the satisfaction of the people you serve, all of your stakeholders, not just the people served, families, the staff, board members, the other community at large. And so everything from detail work and committee planning and reviewing of all our policies and procedures to there were some documents we didn't have that we had never considered before that we had to get together and look at.
For example, the review made Lifestyles review its risk management policies regarding severe weather. While the policy included procedures relating to tornadoes in the area, Maynard says the accreditation survey made the nonprofit realize they had no policy regarding severe ice storms. Although the review scrutinizes every aspect of the organization, Maynard says accreditation is something that Lifestyles pursued for the good of the organization, but she is unsure whether that accreditation will result in new grant or other funding availabilities.
We went through the survey process really to better ourselves. That was really the primary goal, was just looking at how high the standards were and that's what we wanted to strive for. We're not sure yet. We haven't looked into that as to whether or not there are funding sources that specifically look to CARF accreditation.
The accreditation lasts for 3 years, and Maynard says the only other CARF-accredited area organization providing services to people with disabilities is the Elizabeth Richardson Center. Construction begins today on improvements along 7 miles of Interstate 540 between Interstate 40 in Van Buren and Rogers Avenue in Fort Smith. Joe Shipman is the District 4 engineer for the Arkansas Highway Department, and he says while the project will not add capacity to the stretch of the interstate, it will bring other benefits when complete.
Once they do the lane closure and move all traffic to the right-hand lane, on that section, they will turn around and go southbound on 540 from I-40 to the Rogers Avenue area and reduce that to one lane. This will allow the contractor to reconstruct the inside shoulders, the left-hand shoulders of the interstate, and also to construct crossovers in the median area for the main lanes and also ramps. So as construction progresses, they will actually move traffic to one set of lanes with a barrier wall separating traffic so they can undertake work in an individual lane and have that full area to work in.
In addition, 9 bridges are slated for replacement as part of the project, which is expected to wrap up sometime in the middle of next year. Until then, Shipman says safety should be drivers' primary concern when traveling through the construction areas.
The primary thing that motorists should keep in mind is that with the volume of traffic we have, alternate routes should be considered dependent upon their starting and ending points. There are a variety of routes that can be taken. They need to realize if they do travel through this section that they should expect delays due to the construction and due to the traffic congestion. As they travel through the project, we ask that they pay attention to the traffic around them and maintain a steady pace with other traffic and maintain separation between themselves and other traffic.
Speeds in the work zones will be reduced from 65 to 55 miles an hour. And just as a reminder, Arkansas law states that fines are doubled for all moving traffic violations cited in a work zone with workers and signs present. The Bentonville Bella Vista Chamber of Commerce has a new president this week. Last Friday, the chamber announced Dana Davis as its new CEO and president. According to thecitywire.com, Davis formerly served as deputy director of the West Virginia Economic Development Office and as the chief deputy attorney general for the state of West Virginia. Davis starts his duties as chamber president on March 4th. The University of Arkansas marked the construction of its newest building on Friday in a beam signing ceremony for Founders Hall. The 6-story housing and dining hall being built on Dixon Street will provide 214 beds in more than 114 single and double rooms and will add 225 dining seats in addition to existing dining space on the second floor of neighboring Bruff Commons. The building is set to cost $26.5 million and construction is expected to be complete in time for the fall semester. Tonight's weather forecast for the KUAF listening area calls for cloudy conditions with a 30% chance of showers with lows around 30 degrees. Tomorrow will be breezy with a 90% chance of precipitation and highs in the low 70s. Tomorrow night, expect cloudy skies with a 50% chance of rain with lows in the upper 30s to lower 40s. During the winter months, it's not unusual for students to stare longingly at the gloomy sky, praying for the snow to fall. Even with a few days off during winter break, young academics still hope for the occasional snow day. While some schools have already canceled classes this month, some of the closings haven't been due to inclement weather. Some schools have canceled class because of illness. Westville Public Schools in Adair County, Oklahoma, for example, canceled classes for 2 days due to a flu outbreak earlier this month. Last Thursday and Friday, all 3 schools in the Eureka Springs District shuttered their doors due to illness and high absenteeism. Superintendent Curtis Turner Jr. says he spoke to principals earlier in the week before canceling class, a decision that can be difficult to make because there is no hard and fast rule for closing school due to illness.
There's not a magic number, nor a rule that we go by. But what I have always used over the years is when my student count gets to, or absentee rate gets to the 20% mark or better, then I have to start taking a very close look at whether or not we need to be in school.
Turner says the district's student population totals a little more than 600 children. He says they had been monitoring the absentee rate for a number of days before he called a meeting with principals last Wednesday morning. At that time, he says 19 to 20% of the student population was out with an illness. Turner also says one school had 15 or 16 staff members out as well. Unlike a snow day when classes can be canceled in the middle of the day, should a storm become too dangerous, Turner made the decision to finish the school day Wednesday because of how many people would be affected by the cancellation.
When you make a decision like this that affects so many people, parents have to have the opportunity to make arrangements. For those kids, let's say, that are not sick, have to make arrangements for baby, you know, if both parents work, it gives us time as a school district to start the process of actually shutting things down for a couple of days.
Although the Eureka Springs schools were closed, several staff members still worked last week.
The only people that I've had in today are, of course, office personnel, as well as all of our custodial staff. Everybody has been busy since early this morning, cleaning buildings and doing their normal maintenance and stuff on the building, but then also we have been sterilizing rooms and even the buses. You know, I've got our transportation director in, and they're doing that as we speak.
Once officials make the decision to cancel classes, they also have to make the decision of when students and teachers can return to the classroom.
Dismissing for one day really doesn't do a lot of good. I think you have to dismiss a couple of days here with the weekend coming up, making a four-day weekend, you might say, and give kids and staff an opportunity to get healthy and to mend in the interim. Of course, this morning we're completely going back through our buildings again, and which we have clean buildings anyway, but we're re-cleaning everything and sterilizing and not only buildings but buses and doing everything we can to try to control the sickness that we've had.
Turner notes this is a rare occurrence and he has only experienced it one other time in his career.
I remember one time, it was years and years ago, we had a stomach virus and it got to the point that we had so many kids out that we did have to shut down for a couple of days. From the educational standpoint, we're much better off to do that because, you know, if that many kids are gone, then it slows down what we can do with the kids that we have in school versus when those other the kids that are sick come back. Then and of course now in this case with staff, we have to go back and reteach so many of those things. So, you know, I prefer letting everybody get well and let's get things back to normal, as quickly as we can.
For now, Turner says the missed days will count as snow days. He says districts are mandated to build 5 snow days into their school calendars each year. If they use more than 5 days, they will have to tack on days to the end of the year or find some other way to adjust the schedule because he says schools are required to have at least 178 days of teacher-student interaction days. Another district that has been affected by illness this month is the Springdale Public Schools District. However, unlike Eureka Springs, only one school was affected. Hellstern Middle School was closed January 18th due to norovirus, an illness that can cause your stomach or intestines or both to get inflamed. Rick Schaefer, Communications Director for Springdale Public Schools, says the incident was unprecedented.
This is the first time that call's been made in Springdale in over 3 decades, and beyond that, we wouldn't know. That's how long the superintendent's been here. The reason they called school at Hellstern that particular time was because of the unusually high number of absences. Early in the week, there was very few absences. We weren't in school Monday. Tuesday we were. Wednesday we were. The absences weren't that unusual. But then Thursday, there were over 200 kids that were absent before the day even started. And during the course of the day, nearly 100 kids went home because they got sick while at school. And That's highly, highly unusual. So you're talking about, by the end of the school day, 34% of that school's population was gone. And they really didn't know the reason for it. So, therefore, in consulting with the Washington County health officials and then with the state of Arkansas health officials, it was determined that that was probably the best course of action.
Schaefer says Hellstern has a population of 916 kids, and after some testing, officials learned that several of the six students had been affected by norovirus. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, norovirus is the most common cause of acute gastroenteritis in the United States. Each year, it causes about 21 million illnesses and is the most common cause of foodborne disease outbreaks in the U.S.
During the course of the day, we had a lot of kids come to the nurse's office and office who were throwing up, suffering from diarrhea. Those were major symptoms of norovirus. And so it wasn't an easy day. In fact, I was talking to the secretary there the morning when you're starting to get kids absent. I mean, it's call after call after call after call. My son's not going to be there. My daughter's not going to be there. You know, and it was, we just never had a day like that at any school. Normally at this time of year, and we've been very fortunate, we really haven't seen a lot of flu, but normally at this time of year, you're running maybe 5% of your district is absent, and we have an unusually large district. We're the second largest in Arkansas with over 20,000 kids, but 5% would be about normal. So obviously to get hit with 34% in one day is what has never happened to us before.
To help combat the spread of the illness, Schaefer says all buses, not just the ones that run to Hellstern Middle School, were sterilized the night before the school was closed.
The next morning, the buses that usually run the Hellstern routes did run the routes, just in case there would be kids that would come out and think that there was still school, they hadn't gotten the word. Fortunately, there weren't many, but there were some. And then what the bus driver would do would be he would make sure that that student got back in the house before the bus driver would leave. We also had 10 cars that actually came up to school. People usually drive their kids to school, and the principal met them, explained to them what was going on. They said fine, took their kids home.
Schaefer says, according to state health officials, norovirus goes through your system in 24 to 48 hours. So school officials decided a three-day weekend would give ill students plenty of time to recuperate. With the Martin Luther King Jr. Day holiday, students were actually given 4 days to rest. And Schaefer says the absentee rate was down to 9% when classes resumed last Tuesday. It continued to decline after that. Because they did have to close for a day, Schaefer says the school is working with the Arkansas Department of Education to determine whether or not that day will be treated like a snow day. According to the Arkansas Department of Health, the flu season typically lasts from December through March. For more information on the flu, including information on symptoms, complications, and vaccinations, visit healthy.arkansas.gov. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Recent events like the ARC Challenge, which we reported on last fall, have given local startups a chance to grow by connecting would-be entrepreneurs with mentors and potential investors. Last week, some heavyweight business mentors were in Northwest Arkansas as guests of the University of Arkansas Office of Entrepreneurship and the Northwest Arkansas Council. While they were here, they met with students and local startups. Before they left, they came to KUAF to talk about their work. Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums has this report.
The three mentors invited to Northwest Arkansas brought with them an impressive set of experiences. Lane Becker has started or helped start several companies associated with the web, including Get Satisfaction and Adaptive Path. It was Adaptive Path that, years ago, coined the term blog. Prem Jovalia is an investor and founder of Help With Sales, a firm that helps companies with strategy. He also founded Mentor Camp, an outfit that helps growing companies connect to experts in related fields. And Nimish Patel is the former chief operating officer of AOL Europe. I asked the three of them what they're able to do when they visit with a founder or co-founders of a startup that they haven't met before. Lane Becker says an obvious important step for any startup is the ability to describe the would-be project's possibilities in a simple, easy-to-understand synopsis.
The technology or the knowledge that goes behind that pitch can actually be quite complex, but your job is to figure out how to distill it down and make it simple. So then you have people like the three of us who can come in and we can actually work with you. Let's say you haven't quite got to that place. Let's say your pitch has only gotten to a medium level of complexity. I have that experience a lot. So working with the teams to help them figure out how to get it from that down to something that's simple and easy to understand is a lot of what we do.
He says a great idea is a solid foundation for a startup, but usually a great idea is not enough. He says the phrase, ideas are worth nothing and execution is everything, has a solid footing in the truth.
I mean, there really is something to that. You see it all the time. There will be, I remember I was sort of in the South Park neighborhood in San Francisco when Twitter came out, and you guys probably don't know this, but there were at least three other companies that were doing something very, very similar to what Twitter did at the time that it launched. What is the reason that Twitter succeeded? It wasn't that they had the best technology. In fact, their technology was quite flaky for the first couple of years. It was that they understood the product, they understood the market, they understood who they were talking to, they thought about growth and execution in a way that the other teams just were unable to do.
Lane Becker was in Silicon Valley during a time when that area was a fertile spot for creating companies that would become influential in the emerging digital landscape. Prem Jovalia says while there is no guarantee Northwest Arkansas will become a similarly abundant business environment, he thinks many of the required elements are present.
Absolutely. One of the great things about, I've been running this thing called MentorCamp with the support of my two colleagues here. And what MentorCamp does is it goes around the world looking at certain cities and geographies with unique characteristics. And one of the things we've seen in Fayetteville is it's really got all the ingredients. It's got the right culture, it's got the right talent, and it's got the right ethos. And I think, one of the talks I first heard Lane speak at was about the Silicon Valley culture. Because people try to replicate lots and lots of things, but what's very difficult to replicate is that invisible glue, you know, the culture, that willingness to give something back and the willingness to help and mean it. Everybody says they want to help, but actually when you come to a place like Fayetteville, you see people mean it. And it's been I think I speak for all three of us when we say we've been like wowed by the people and the generosity people have towards each other in terms of helping. So in answering your question about whether you can get that entrepreneurial scene set up in Fayetteville, I think I speak for the three of us when I say that we've been very impressed with what we've seen, and it's alive and kicking, and it's actually not that easy to replicate.
If this region has the right atmosphere for entrepreneurship and resources like the University of Arkansas's Office of Entrepreneurship, that's still not enough to propel a new venture. There almost always has to be money. And Nimish Patel, another of the visiting mentors last week, says investment capital is out there.
The job of a really good financier is to assess risk. And with startups, as you well know, there's possibly out of every 10, there's probably 9 failures. But effectively, the job of a really good investment manager, venture capitalist, or private equity person is to really assess company by company, you know, what that risk looks like and to spread that risk. So they understand what they're doing. And as you see, there's increasing flows of capital towards the venture end, particularly with this spate of really exciting new startups that begin to disrupt traditional industries and so forth. So I think, you know, whilst you could say that there is failure is a bad thing, I think a lot of investment managers now and have since the test of time basically just understand that you have to place bets to make money and to generate returns.
An idea, a plan, financial backing, and Lane Becker says a dollop of old-fashioned good luck doesn't hurt. He co-authored a book titled Get Lucky, How to Put Planned Serendipity to Work for You and Your Business.
One of the best presentations I ever saw was not long after Google went public, and Sergey Brin, who is one of the two co-founders of Google, was on stage. And so this was, remember, mid-2000s, so people are not as used to the idea. In the mid-2000s, everybody thought the web was dead and over. And then there was this one company, Google, that comes out, and all of a sudden they start minting money, and then they end up taking it public. And so he's on stage, and the interviewer, this guy John Battelle, asks him, because everyone wants to know, what is the number one thing? What would you say was the critical contributor to your success? And Sergey Brin goes, oh, that was easy. It was luck. And we're talking about like one of the most successful entrepreneurs on the planet. So it is luck and timing. It's not that you can't affect that. It's not that you can't work through it. But that is a significant piece of it.
So is there any last bit of advice from these three veterans of business startups when it comes to engaging in your own bit of entrepreneurship, of taking the risk? Yes. Perhaps, they say, you should reconsider one more time before making that commitment.
If somebody is just listening to what we're saying and is suddenly inspired to be an entrepreneur, I would say don't be. Seriously, stay at home, because most of the entrepreneurs I know, they have this bug that they can't get rid of, and you don't really need the final push. The final push has to come from within. You don't need to be inspired by others. You just want to do it because it's something you just can't get rid of.
A lot of people have great ideas that could potentially disrupt, change, make the world a better place. If you are unsure that you want to be an entrepreneur, I would strongly suggest a significant process of validation. And you will, if you're asking yourself the question, should I actually jump in, perhaps I would say that you're not as yet passionate enough about your idea.
And this is where Lane Becker says it's always good to learn through experience, but even better to learn through others' experiences.
Much more capital efficient, much less time intensive. So a big part of mentoring for me when I go out and do it is very much that. I mean, you have to be wary of the fact that we're in a fast-changing industry, and something that might not have worked before might suddenly, you know, and the next year be something that works incredibly well, and vice versa. But for me, being able to just at least give the exposure of my experience is a really big part of what's important to me. The other thing that I really enjoy, and this is sort of a personal mission that I'm on, is I really enjoy connecting up the different regions. I think it's really fantastic to be able to take knowledge and experience that has worked in one region and move it somewhere else and say, you know what, we already tried that and we did it and it worked this way and we think it would work really well for you to do it that way over here. And alongside that, you can transfer knowledge. These days you can transfer people, you can certainly transfer capital. And a lot of that actually flows around, for me, the prospect of mentoring and really kind of getting in deep with a founder to understand what it is that they do.
The best mentors don't have the best answers, they have the best questions. So Lane is actually one of my mentors, and Lane constantly asks me certain questions. And those questions just make me think, oh, wow. I've yet to meet a mentor who will tell me what to do, and that's not what a mentor should do. A mentor should just, you know, ask you questions and make you think, you know, think about things about for yourself.
But of course, there are those launching new businesses, and some of them have distinct Northwest Arkansas connections. Tomorrow on Ozarks at Large, we'll have an update on a company that competed in the Arc Challenge, a startup competition in Northwest Arkansas last year, but that didn't win the big prize. Still, the co-founders of Sooligan are in New Orleans this week to kick off their big push for their social media search product.
Well, we're hoping to kind of replicate the social media command center that was done at last year's Indianapolis Super Bowl. So, you know, last year they had a group of volunteers kind of managing search queries that are coming on Twitter or Facebook and other social media platforms. However, they had actual people running around answering questions from visitors. And of course, you know, not everyone will bump into each other. So we're putting this effort in the hands of everyone, locals and visitors alike.
Tomorrow they'll explain what they've learned so far and what they hope is next for their company. And you can hear more from the conversation with the mentors Lane Becker, Purnjo Valia, and Nimesh Patel that was recorded inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio in an audio extra that you can find right now at ozarksatlarge.com. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Kyle Kellums.
And applications for the next ARC Challenge are now being accepted at arcchallenge.org. More information can be found at our webpage, ozarksatlarge.com. It's Monday, January 28th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Isn't it about time for our regular, it's what month of what year?
I know.
Oy vey.
Can you believe?
I can't. So we need to go and de-stress at the library.
Okay.
And do some yoga.
You know, I've never done yoga.
I've done Tai Chi.
Yeah?
I'm not peaceful enough for yoga, I don't think.
That I may have to agree that I'm the same way.
You think?
Yeah.
5:30 today at the library. Or you can go to the Bella Vista Library and get in on their evening readers book club. They're discussing The Roundhouse by Louise Erdrich. 6:00.
All right. Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
They say a love bug will get you at the...
Why Don't You Haul Off and Love Me is an enduring song of the mid-20th century that has been a hit in several genres. The song has been recorded by country stalwarts like Red Foley, Porter Wagner, and Red Sovine, as well as Pat Boone and Rosemary Clooney. And Why Don't You Haul Off and Love Me has several Arkansas connections. Co-writer Wayne Rainey of Wolf Bayou, Arkansas, had the first hit with Why Don't You Haul Off and Love Me when he took it to number one in 1949. Rainey recorded as a solo artist with King Records. He soon earned a spot on the Grand Ole Opry due to his success. Co-author of the song was Lonnie Glosson of Judsonia, Arkansas. In addition to recording and writing, the harmonica-playing duo of Rainey and Glosson sold alleged millions of harmonicas over the radio. Wayne Rainey was born in 1920. Born in 1908, the elder Lonnie Glosson mentored Rainey, and the two worked together for about a decade. Glosson gave probably his last interview to Arkansongs when he was 92 and living in his native White County.
Wayne, he was a harmonica player too. He learned from me. So we got together back in 48 and played together. Then we was on, me and Wayne, we was on 200 stations every night. You know, stations everywhere.
Hot Springs native Henry Glover was an A&R man for King Records who worked in country, rock, R&B, and more. Glover and Wayne Rainey share writing credit with the Delmore brothers on the Delmore song Blues Stay Away From Me, another huge hit for King Records and said to be written on the same day as Why Don't You Haul Off and Love Me. Both songs had incredible crossover appeal. Mere months after Wayne Rainey had a chart-topping hit with Why Don't You Haul Off and Love Me in 1949 on King, Bull Moose Jackson recorded a version of the song for the R&B division of King. It hit number two on the R&B charts.
Why don't you haul off and love me one more time? Why don't you squeeze me until I'm turning blind? If you don't cuddle up and love me like I want you to do, I'm going to haul off and die over you.
Bull Moose Jackson is not an Arkansas artist, but was in Lucky Millinder's band, which had two of the state's finest as members. Vocalist and guitarist Sister Rosetta Tharp of Cotton Plant, Arkansas, was a featured performer, while the ever-ubiquitous Henry Glover played trumpet for Lucky Millinder's band. But Henry Glover was also so much more. A musician, arranger, producer, and a great songwriter, the Garland County native was among the first black country music executives. He and King Records were also adept at bridging and exploiting the perceived gaps between white and black music markets. King Records of Cincinnati, Ohio, promoted artists in country, hillbilly, R&B, and beyond, and Glover became an important part of all aspects of it for the label.
I'm going to haul off and die over you.
Hoping for even more legs for the song Why Don't You Haul Off and Love Me, Ouachita County, Arkansas native Little Willie John again recorded it for King Records in 1960 on his second album. Although Willie John had been seen as a prodigy, Henry Glover had been the first to record him in the mid-1950s. John was a teenager when he cut hits like Fever and All Around the World, and Glover was in charge of most of Willie John's sessions. While Arkansas-ers Henry Glover and Little Willie John are unsung innovators of rhythm and blues music, Arkansas-ers Wayne Rainey and Lonnie Glosson are unsung innovators of hillbilly and country music. And no matter whose version, Why Don't You Haul Off and Love Me exemplifies the varied talents Arkansas has produced and how the confluence of these talents could produce a unique style with appeal in many quarters. Here in its entirety is Little Willie John of Cullendale, Arkansas with Why Don't You Haul Off and Love Me, written by Wolf Bayou native Wayne Rainey and Judsonia native Lonnie Glosson and produced by Henry Glover of Hot Springs.
Why don't you haul off and love me one more time? Why Don't You Haul Off and Love Me by Little Willie John of Ouachita County, produced by Hot Springs native Henry Glover on King Records, and written by Wayne Rainey of Wolf Bayou and Lonnie Glosson of Judsonia. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. For more information, visit arkansongs.org.
This is Ozarks at Large. For the typical teenager, life is full of plenty of everyday struggles. Fitting in with friends, completing homework on time, dealing with family. But what about having the added pressure of fighting to protect the fate of the world? In The Steward, the first of four books in the Wheeled Fae Journals series, Cuban-Irish teenager Maggie O'Shea relocates with her family from Florida to the Ozark Mountains. While spending time on her family's land, she discovers the world of the Fae, or fairies. She also uncovers the important role she may play in protecting the Fae's sacred land. This fantasy series is the creation of Chris Shields, a professor of criminal justice at the University of Arkansas. Chris has spent years in the world of academia and has degrees in criminal justice, sociology, public policy, and law. Chris recently came by the studio to talk about the first book in his series, and while he was here, I asked him how all of these degrees resulted in him becoming a writer.
My friends have told me I have more degrees than a thermometer. I don't know. I love learning, and I've always enjoyed that. And one of the things I also enjoy is kind of that creative outlet. And after I finished my PhD, I said, absolutely no more. Because the question among my friends and family, okay, what degree next? And I said, this is it. This is it. No more. But, you know, the evenings, I'd just kind of started piddling around with, you know, other things. I mean, I have all this spare time, you know, it's a huge joke, of course, but just for fun. And it actually, the writing came about from prepping for a class I was teaching. I taught it for the first time 3 years ago, serial crime. And it was really dark, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
Doing all the background reading and setting up the course. And so I did that through the summer in the mornings. And then the evenings, I needed something just lighthearted that I could escape. And writing was what did it for me. It was just such a wonderful world to go to. I've actually enjoyed these books, writing these books, so much. The only thing I like more is teaching.
Do you have any sort of background as a writer?
Not formally. I mean, I wrote...
lots of papers for all your degrees.
Oh, yeah. I've done a lot. I've done a lot of academic writing, and when I was a lawyer, I did a lot of legal writing. As far as creative writing goes, I wrote my first play in the fourth grade. I actually got in trouble. My fourth grade teacher, Mrs. Parks, caught me. We were watching a film, and I was writing a play, a Christmas play. And she grabbed the notebook and went up to the front of the class and started reading it. And she came back and handed it to me and said, you go right ahead and write. In my fourth grade class, we put it on as a class in the classroom because I created parts for everyone. And so that was kind of the first experience. And I've done it off and on through high school. I wrote nothing I ever tried to get published, but I wrote stories that I'd let my parents read. And I won an essay writing contest in high school my senior year. But I never really considered writing until about 4 years ago.
And so you started working on this about 2 years ago, I guess 2012?
Yeah, the initial idea for it came in 2011, and I began working on it probably about did the research in the summer of 2010. And then I had the first book written over a year and a half ago because I tried to go through traditional publishers, and to do that you have to go through agents, 196 agents later, and I couldn't even get them to look at anything more than a query letter. I just decided to go ahead and self-publish, because that is the trend now.
It is, very much so. And this is a young adult fantasy / romance novel. And there seems like there's a lot of those out there. I mean, it seems, you know, a couple years back with the Twilight coming out, that series being very popular with the vampires. And it seems you can't go to a bookstore where the teen section isn't, you know, vampires, fallen angels, probably zombies in there a little bit, and even with some dystopian novels like the Hunger Games, it seems to kind of be very in right now. So this book dealing with fairies seems very on trend with that. So with so many of these types of stories out there, I mean, do you try and set yourself apart, or do you just go for it because this is what you like?
No, I absolutely did try to set myself apart, and I tried with the protagonist. I did not want to do the classic love triangle. I mean, that it's so overdone. And, you know, readers spot it a mile away. Mm-hmm. And I've had a number of people who have read it leave comments, and they thought from reading the description and starting out that it was going to be just another Twilight / fill in the blank. And most of them have been pleasantly surprised because I do not take that route. I thought long and hard about the outline. I have the entire series outlined. That's how I work. I just mm-hmm. do an outline and work from it. But I did try to set it apart. And all those layers you're talking about, also, one of the things I tried to do was to make it as believable as possible, you know, providing explanations of why no one knows about the Fae.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, why the family is so secretive about the Fae, and I just had the best time doing it. And as it, you know, over that summer, as it slowly fell together, and I had these epiphanies, and I was like, oh my gosh, that's going to be fantastic. But yeah, I had so much fun putting it together. See, I'm one of those that I would read a book or watch a movie and go, you know, I would have done something different. I would have done this mm-hmm. here. And I'm terrible about, you know, especially with movies, picking out problems and gaps and holes. I just can't stand them. And so I really tried to be cognizant of making sure that there weren't gaps in logic, or at least they were believable. Because, I mean, you do have to have a flight of fancy and use your imagination.
Sure.
But, yeah.
So in the story of the protagonist, Maggie, her aunt is sometimes responsible for some of the explanations, as you mentioned. And so she's very much a storyteller. You know, truth to Maggie, some less truth to the townspeople, if you will.
Right.
So the storyteller, as I understand it, your grandfather was quite the storyteller, and he sort of helped inspire this?
Yeah. Well, the storytelling part he did, not mm-hmm. the story itself.
Right.
My dad's father, I actually kind of make a reference. I've always wanted to write a book to recount some of his folklore and his own tales, and call it Alton's Kitchen Table Prevarications and Other Bald-Faced Lies. And I dropped that title in the book.
Uh-huh.
Because my grandfather absolutely taught me how to tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
And he told me the same stories over and over, but each time they got a little bigger, they got a little bolder. And you knew when he was about to tell you a big lie. He would circle his lips or make an O with his lips and push his tongue into his cheek. And inevitably, the story changed and it got bigger and bolder. And I just loved listening to his stories. Didn't believe a word he said, but that wasn't the point. He was, you know, that generation where they entertained in very, very much a kind of an Ozark, you know, kind of feel, because all the stories had to do with the Ozarks or Oklahoma, Green Country in Oklahoma. But yeah, love my grandfather's storytelling.
And like Maggie's family, your family has kind of owned the same amount of land for a while.
They haven't owned the land, but my father's side of the family settled in this area in the 1850s. And my mom's side of the family has been in and out of the area for a long time. No, we don't own the land. I would love to be able to inherit 27 acres.
Sure.
But yeah, I have family members all over Northwest Arkansas, Northeastern Oklahoma, and I used to have some family members in Southwest Missouri, some cousins still. Yeah, we've been here for a very long time. And it was, I just feel tied to this place.
Well, you mentioned research earlier in the interview, and I know you researched, you know, folklore from Celtic, Scottish, English folklore, some more information from the Osage and the Cherokee. What was that research like, and why those particular cultures?
Well, it has to tie into what happens in the second, particularly the third book, when it becomes much more global. Because what I always wanted to do was to find a story that was centered in Northwest Arkansas. And I love fantasy stories. And the problem with a lot of fantasy stories, they pick, you know, either sexy locations or locations that don't exist. And I wanted, you know, to kind of highlight how I consider it magical, you know, the Ozarks. If you've ever been hiking or driven through a valley on an early morning and there's a deep fog, the sunsets, the changes of weather, it really is magical. And there's so many folk stories that tie into not necessarily the same beliefs, but similar beliefs. And if you go back far enough, I mean, the Osage, and I'm part Osage, part Cherokee, and so I kind of have a, you know, connection there. But the Osage, this was their land. And then after they moved to Oklahoma, then, you know, the Cherokees had settled in this area for a brief period of time in the early 19th century. So I wanted to play tribute and use their folklore and tie it all together, because one of the problems I have with a lot of fantasy stories, it seems like some authors, and I enjoy them, but some authors just throw in every possible type of creature imaginable. I wanted one mythological race of beings that could basically, I don't want to give too much away, but take any shape and be, you know, kind of the catalyst for all of these different myths around the world to make it much more believable. So I had to pay tribute to Native American legends. I just absolutely had to.
Well, I thought that was one of the most interesting parts is when early on when Maggie's sort of being introduced into the world of fairies, the world of the fae, and kind of explaining how all of these, what we consider mythological creatures, are basically one form of a fairy, you know, a troll, a gnome, mermaids, Bigfoot. So that was all your idea.
Yeah.
Was there anything in your research to that maybe inspired that? Were there some cultures where they attributed, say, a mermaid to a type of fairy, or was that really just...
I didn't find anything specifically on that. I mean, I know there's quite a bit out there.
Right.
And even researching the fae, mm-hmm. there are, and I'm not talking about fiction, but, you know, people actually believe in the fae and they've written books, and that's what I did my research on, not from fiction, but from, you know, these spiritual guides and other things about the fae to see what these people believed. And there was no common theme.
Okay.
There were some undertones, but there's so many different versions and so many, you know, diversions. I mean, the belief in the fae, some believe they're fallen angels, mm-hmm. and some believe that they were, or the Seath or She, depending on the pronunciation used in Ireland, that they were the descendants of Tuatha De Danann and all of these different things. And so I just wanted to kind of step away from what people believed, those people who do believe, and what people had written about, and just kind of create something believable, because that was my goal all along, was just to create believability. But at the same time, I had an argument. We watch, some friends and I, we occasionally watch the show on Bigfoot Hunters and just get the biggest kick out of it.
Uh-huh.
And one of my friends said, absolutely, positively, no way. And so I threw in Sasquatch and Bigfoot uh-huh. in this just as a joke, as a way to explain, well, actually, they, at least in this world, they do exist. They're fake.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It takes place in the Ozarks, you mm-hmm. know, specifically around Eureka Springs, and there's mentions of Fayetteville and her swim team in Bentonville and things like that. Because you're dealing with a real place and one that probably local readers are very familiar with, do you feel that you have to remain completely true to the things that are there? Do you feel liberty to create, you know, this shop on the corner or things like that? I mean, you mentioned real things like the Christ of the Ozarks, the what do the kids refer to it as? The chalk monster?
Yeah, I'd heard that years ago when I was visiting Eureka. Some friends of mine, we went to the Crescent Hotel mm-hmm. and we're up on the observation lounge on the back. And one of my friends said that, and I cracked up. I just thought it was the funniest thing I'd ever heard. And I realized that, you know, it could be very offensive, so I apologize if it offends.
Sure.
But, I did want one of the things about books I love is when you read something like Dan Brown's. You read something, you sit and you can Google it, and you're like, oh, my gosh. And there's a real place.
Mm-hmm.
And before I started writing the first book, I mentioned the Garden Street Bistro.
Right.
In Eureka. And so I asked for the owner's permission. And then
okay.
Turpentine Creek, I went and I asked for their permission. And as I did want to use real places. Now, I refer to a restaurant that doesn't exist and a couple other places, although it's based off a restaurant that is there. But I just, if I'm actually going to have a character interacting with a place a lot, mm-hmm. I wanted to ask for permission first.
And another, I guess, local character, if you will, that makes an appearance in the book, Coin Harvey. How did you come up with the idea for explaining sort of his, I guess, rise and downfall by using
yeah.
the fairies? I was very amused by that.
Well, you know, in the original draft of the book was 216,000 words. This mm-hmm. is about 102,000, so I cut over half the book out.
Wow.
Yeah.
Did
I just sat down and wrote
the second
and
book,
love. Well, no, part of it, there's the very first trial, and this was the Earth trial, mm-hmm. and that actually happened in the original book, original draft. It happened in chapter 16 rather than beginning in chapter 1 through 3.
Right.
And and I wanted to make it as believable as possible, and so I wanted to tie in local Ozark folklore to give something, you know, give people something to chew on. And so, and I love the story of Montanay and Coin Harvey, and I've, you know, read about him for years. Because you grew up in Northwest Arkansas, you can't help but hear about Montanay and Coin Harvey. And I've always kind of had this romantic fascination with places that no longer exist.
That's an excellent example.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's, all that's left now is just a ruin. And in the last 2 years, they put a chain link fence around it to keep it from being vandalized.
They have. Mm-hmm.
But the first time I visited, I just remember feeling so haunted by it. And I just, and thank goodness for the internet, I've been able to do a lot more research and see the pictures of the gondolas and the proposed pyramid he wanted to build and the amphitheaters. And it's just, yeah, I just felt like I wanted to bring some of those local myths and legends in. Of course, that wasn't a myth, but I changed it up to be able to explain it.
Chris Shields is the author of the Wheeled Fae Journal series and a criminal justice professor at the University of Arkansas. He recently came by the studio to discuss The Steward, the first book in the series. The first and second book in the series are available on Amazon.com. Locally, the books can be found at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville and Turpentine Creek Wildlife Refuge in Eureka Springs. Chris says he hopes to release the third book of the series in April. If you would like to meet the author, he will have a book signing from 1 to 3 p.m. February 9th at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville. More information is available at Wheeled, that's W-E-A-L-D, Fae, F-A-E, journals.com.
North Korea delivers a blunt warning. Expect another nuclear test. And the country's new leader insists its arsenal of long-range rockets is designed to hit the United States. I'm Neil Conan. Why North Korea works so hard to maintain us as its mortal enemy, and what drives these latest threats, plus the opinion page. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation this afternoon at 1, immediately following this edition of Ozarks at Large, here on KUAF 91.3 FM. A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas, this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Eureka Springs. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. I will be back along with my co-host, Kyle Kellums. Thanks again for listening, and I hope your week is off to a fantastic start.